We are at the Santa Fe Institute at a workshop on systems biology and the physical foundations of aging with Caleb Finch, a human biologist from the University of Southern California, more generally known to his friends and colleagues as Tuck Finch. Welcome. What's the sense of where the workshop is going in terms of systems biology, looking at aging as a systems problem?
Well, this was a very exciting convocation of a group of people, many of whom knew each other by name, but not by face. And a number of dialogues evolved from different points of view of that are pertinent to understanding aging of complex organisms and simple organisms, defining new parameters using the new technology that's at hand. And at the end of the day, we avoided the definition or worrying about the definition of what was systems aging and recognized that whatever terminology, we were on the threshold of being able to deal with much more complex systems and questions evolving over longer time spans than has been possible before in biology, molecular biology, physiology. So I think many of us have started new discussions that will lead to specific grants and specific programs.
You put in the sort of chalk talk that you did, the short talk, you listed some puzzles that required integrated approaches. So presumably the systems approach would work. One of them was a relationship of morbidity to mortality. So for people who don't know terms of art, how would you?
Well, mortality is death. Morbidity has to do with defined clinical problems. Heart disease, diabetes, having had a fall, those are examples of morbidity. Things that don't necessarily kill you, but once you have a condition, increase the risk of further health deterioration. And one of the puzzles here is that women seem to acquire more morbidities with age, yet they outsurvive men. So that's called the female paradox of morbidity, and it's observed in all of the populations that have been looked at. And it's a puzzle. Why are women able to outsurvive difficulties that kill men?
And we have no clue?
No serious answer on it. And I posed this to my colleagues as an example of something that can't be reduced to a single factor and requires a more thorough analysis of complex interactions.
Mm-hmm. You dealt with this whole notion of caloric restriction. And its capacity to delay aging.
Yeah, remarkable effects in some lab animals, not all, and open question as to whether it works on primates. There's no doubt that if you are obese and diabetic, that caloric restriction improves your health and lowers your mortality risk. Whether this applies as strongly to people who are otherwise healthy is the open question.
Yeah, you also talked about whether these risk factors for diseases, like measuring C-reactive protein,
yes,
to see inflammation levels and so on, why they in fact explained only a small fraction.
Yes, so this is a...
Because there's a huge amount of attention goes to it.
Huge. So the current medical culture finds it convenient and reasonable, I think, to identify risk factors for single variables. So elevated C-reactive protein or IL-6 or blood pressure above a certain level certainly can increase the risk of a heart attack or a stroke. But it's also absolutely clear that there are many individuals who have those conditions and who don't have a heart attack or a stroke in a short period of time. So it's the reduction of all of this is that individual parameters like that don't explain much of the individual variability or variance in mortality. And the question is, how are we going to get a better, more comprehensive grasp of individual risk factors and how they interact to explain the life expectancy?
So we don't actually have, as Jeffrey West would put, the theoretical physicist's equivalent of a theory of aging that summarizes the whole.
What we know is it's genetic. If you have the genes of a mouse, you'll live as long as a mouse. If you have the genes of a human, you'll live as long as a human. Was that helpful? Not really.
Right. Also confusing were some of the talks in which one would see, for example, that the life expectancy has been going up and up and up over
time. In the last 200 years,
yes. Right. At the same time, nobody's lived beyond 122 and a half.
So it appears.
Years. But then if I ask somebody, does that mean we're programmed to die? They will say, no. Now, these seem very confusing and mutually...
You have to stick to observations. And the observation is that if you reach the age of 100 and roughly 1 in 10,000 people do reach the age of 100, then your mortality risk is about 50% a year. And extremely high, and may increase if you get to be 105 and maybe even higher. So that seems to be a property of the human populations that are existing today that obviously reflect some mortality law that you could say does have an upper limit. Now, with the remarkable medical and interventions that have reduced heart disease, the impact of heart disease on mortality, it's possible that as one improvement after the next becomes available, that the chances of reaching 100 will be much greater. And I wouldn't be surprised if the 122-year limit was broken, but so far we haven't gotten there. So at the end of the day, it looks as though somewhere around 120 is the limit for the human genome in the present environments, because lifespan is always influenced by the environment of an organism of whatever set of genes.
Yeah, now, you said something rather unusual as well, which is that here we have this wonderful curve that shows everybody's living long. Well, lots of people, many more people are living longer. Here we have this supplement from The Economist very recently, a special report on aging populations. It's called A Slow-Burning Fuse. It points out that by 2050, the proportion of people who are older is getting, you know, much, much larger, which has certain costs, global issues and global effects and so on. But I understood you to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that because of other environmental factors, you don't think that that curve is necessarily going to keep on going in that.
So let me just start.
Positive trend.
Defining this a little bit more precisely. So since 1800, the industrializing populations have added approximately 1 year of lifespan for every 4 years of historical time, or 5 hours a day for every 24, something like that. So this has varied between nations. Sweden was one of the earliest to get on this curve. Japan only got on this curve in after 1950. And now, as everyone knows, has the longest life expectancy in the world. So this is largely the result, in the case of Japan, of antibiotics. The increase in Swedish lifespans and European lifespans 150 years earlier was due to improved environment that reduced the infectious load, better food, better water. So this has been going on remarkably progressively, at least up to this point. Now, I have severe concerns that there is global deterioration of the environment. We already know across the non-industrialized world that water supplies are deteriorating, and the burning of fossil fuels for transport and of coal for electricity is pumping huge amounts of pollution into the air, which without any question causes damage to the heart and the lungs. And very definitively, areas in the United States which have high air pollution have higher levels of heart disease and maybe many other conditions. So I look at the emergence of the world environment in the 21st century, and it's deteriorating independent of global warming. Now, global warming has a further contribution to this because it increases the demand for air conditioning, which uses a lot of power, which I think will further cause deterioration of local atmosphere. So my anticipation is that, in fact, these recent 100 years of or 200 years of improvement in life expectancy are going to reverse for most populations who are exposed to the deteriorating urban environments. And I anticipate that there will also be a health elite that will be protected by filtered air and the latest medical advances that could well have enjoy continuing increase of life expectancy. So the 21st century, I fear, will look at a global differentiation, stratification of people by health, with a overall deterioration of health against the trends of the 19th and 20th century, which were a remarkable achievement of civilization to improve the level of health to such a degree.
Okay, so in this is one of the points that we keep on making, of course, that there's no point trying to separate an issue like the scientific study of gerontology or aging from these larger societal issues.
They're embedded in it.
Yeah. So, you did a review paper. Here's one possible hope area. I don't know. You did a review recently on negligible senescence, a term that's been somewhat attached to Aubrey de Grey with his strategies for engineered negligible senescence.
And that was a term that I introduced 20 years ago in my first book, Aging, Longevity, and the Genome, and Longevity, Senescence, and the Genome. And I tentatively advanced the idea on the data that was available that some species, in fact, don't show any indications of senescence, and the criteria for senescence are increased functional deterioration, loss of reproduction, and increased mortality rate at later adult ages. Well, we have some very good examples now of turtles and fish that don't seem to show any type of aging at all, and that now are concrete examples of negligible senescence. So meanwhile, the term has gotten legs and walked into many other rooms of the biogerontology enterprise, and I am happy that Aubrey de Grey found it useful, and he's talking about engineering negligible senescence in the particular goal of identifying the causes of morbidity in particular organ systems and enabling their regeneration. So this is a point-for-point patch approach. On the other hand, Michael Rose at UC Irvine has another theoretically based approach on evolution, that evolution genetics enables systems of aging to slow across the entire organism. And so he can, in his laboratory, select for long-lived flies that seem to have slower aging and later onset of mortality accelerations, later deterioration of reproduction, And this involves a number of different genes whose net effect is to slow aging across the system. So this is another strategy in identifying genes that can slow aging and perhaps achieve negligible senescence.
I think there's a general sense that perhaps we've stopped evolving, that, you know, this is of course, there's a book came out recently summarizing some of his research, Henry Harpending, Greg Cochran, The 10,000 Year Explosion, suggesting that in the period that the period that we now inhabit, the period known as the Holocene, that in fact evolution is still, natural selection is still going on, evolution is still going on. Does this have any relevance to the kind of thing?
Well, I think so, because just in terms of the load of infectious disease, the pathogens that we're exposed to, such as influenza, keep changing, and that selects for different adaptive genes that increase resistance and lower mortality. Of course, the medical technology rescues vast numbers of people who would have died from infections, but we all recall the terrible 1918-19 influenza, which killed so vast numbers of millions of people from the infections that were secondary to influenza, and that could easily be imagined in any of the modern influenzas as well.
Tom Kirkwood mentioned, in fact, I think at some point during the proceedings, that there'd been a lot of heated discussion in the UK recently about whether to advise mothers not to become pregnant during this recent swine flu scare, based on evidence from the 1918 flu epidemic, which suggested that there was this causal connection between pregnancy and subsequent problems with.
Well, actually, I think reconstruct that discussion, in my talk, I presented some new data, which is in the process of being published, showing that if individuals who were in utero during the worst phase of the influenza epidemic in the fall of 1918, 60 years later, had a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. Mm. And Tom perceived that as relevant to the discussion in the United Kingdom about risks of pregnancy. He hadn't known of this at the time he was in that discussion. But I think it is a valid discussion.
So that if, for example, if I pick up a paper here from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, persistent epigenetic differences associated with prenatal exposure to famine in humans. I mean, clearly we tend to forget that. Could you just actually unpack the term epigenetics?
So when we talk about heritable traits, we talk about genes in our germline that are passed from parents to children that influence, for example, eye color or height or resistance to disease or vulnerability to disease. So those are DNA signatures of with differences at the DNA level. So epigenetic refers to this other level of regulation of genes influencing the rate at which they are active in a particular cell, and that can be modified by another level of chemistry in the chromosome, which involves the interaction of proteins with particular genes and modified by methylation that influences how tight the proteins bind to particular genes. So the epigenetic above the genome means it's controlling the genome, but with and can be transmitted between generations, but without influencing the structure of the gene itself. So this is a whole remarkable new area of genomic biology that's coming to light, and there's no doubt as this article you're referring to, I believe this is from the Dutch famine. Dutch famine, that individuals who were exposed in utero to
Dutch
nutritional,
winter, 1944,
nutritional, maternal nutritional stress have altered methylation patterns of some of the genes that regulate growth. So this is a remarkable observation, and it just points to the number of powerful ways the environment influences our gene expression and our development over multiple generations. And I should point out something that every developmental biologist knows, but the general public generally doesn't, that the egg we came from was present in our mother's ovary before her birth. So this means that the egg we came from was exposed to the environment of our grandmother's uterus. So we have the capacity here for multi-generational environmental influences on the embryo, which is potentially another level of this environmental gene interaction.
I seem to remember you reading, when I was working on one of my own books, a paper of yours on life history evolution in the Quarterly Journal of Biology.
Quarterly Review of Biology.
Yeah, which is a classic state. But if you, could you just actually, this asking too much to ask you to summarize the thesis that's in there,
so
because it's very important.
So this has to do with the evolution of human longevity and human diet. Our great ape ancestors age much more rapidly and have much shorter lifespans than we do. Essentially, none of them live much beyond 50, and the life expectancy at birth is somewhere around 15 or 20. Whereas in humans, in the worst situations before the Industrial Revolution, when lifespans were short, they were still, life expectancy at birth was 35 to 40, and a fair number of people who reached the age of 20 would reach the age of 60. So almost everybody had one or more grandparents. So human evolution of lifespan has more than doubled from our predecessor of a chimpanzee-like ancestor. But there were utterly remarkable changes in diet, because the great apes largely have a fruit and plant-based diet, very little animal protein, much, much lower than human populations, even the days before the Big Mac, would have far more animal protein across the year that they eat than the great apes. So from what we understand now about animal fat intake as risk factors in longevity, in mortality, we have this paradox that humans became professional meat eaters at the same time as doubling their longevity. And so nutrition, adaptation to this new diet, which we call meat adaptive genes, we propose had an important role in the increase of human longevity. And one of those genes that's a candidate for being meat adaptive in human evolution is apolipoprotein E alleles, E3 and E4. The E3 allele is the modern human allele that emerged about the time of evolution of the modern human species. And it's the good allele in reducing heart disease risk and blood cholesterol and Alzheimer's risk. And at the same time, it also seems to have a role in favoring brain development. Neurons with ApoE3 are bigger than ApoE4. And aging patterns seem to be slower. So this is a gene system of the ApoE alleles that may be a prototype for other genes that involve nutrition and their influences on lifespan, and as well on our other unique capacity that great apes don't have, language and a much larger brain.
When you presented, in fact, yesterday, you used the phrase, I actually noted this down, that you said there was a really scary literature out there.
Yeah, well,
in terms of these apparent cognitive compromises that result from.
So there are a number of observations, probably 15 or 20 papers refer to it, that APOE4 may cause mild developmental defects and lower cognitive scores in children. And in fact, there is one study showing that a part of the cerebral cortex is thinner during childhood development in kids who carry APOE4 versus APOE3. That's a very solid data from Judith Rappaport's group at the NIMH. So it is scary to think that human populations, which have all of them have APOE4 as well as APOE3, carry a gene which influences optimum development, brain development.
But these things are also, there's pleiotropy involved, isn't there as well here? So the reason, as I understood you from what you were saying yesterday, is that the reason that those apparently deleterious genes in some aspects would still be maintained is that they were protective in other environments.
So, yes. So the idea of that I've proposed on APOE3 and APOE4 is that it's a balancing allele system by analogy with sickle cell anemia, which protects against malaria in those environments. So there is a little bit of data showing that under some circumstances, APOE4 is protective for some diseases, particularly hepatitis C, in which APOE4 carriers have less liver damage than APOE3. And there may be also some other evidence forthcoming on resistance to malaria and resistance to diarrhea effects on brain development.
How does this map onto the whole explosion in personal genomics? I mean, I remember Jim Watson saying, for example, there's certain things he didn't want to know about.
The genome. Human genetics community has long recognized that most humans carry one or more gene forms that would be disadvantageous, and that under ordinary circumstances don't do much harm or don't do much good. So the idea of trying to purge the human genome of harmful genes is probably total nonsense.
You made an interesting point at lunch, and it was just an observation, so I don't know whether you've had a chance, whether you're actually planning to follow up on this. And this is with respect to your notion of sort of the escape or the salvation of the health elites, preferential salvation of the health elites. You said you weren't aware of any socioeconomic analysis of the centenarians, the existing ones.
Yes.
Which is surprising. I was surprised when I heard that.
I was surprised when I said it, but I think it's true. I hadn't thought about it until you brought this into the conversation and then that popped to light.
Yeah.
But so, it'd be good to know that. But certainly there's a powerful overall effect on your socioeconomic educational status. I mean, in Alzheimer's disease, for example, people who have not graduated from high school have a several-fold higher risk of Alzheimer's disease at any age. But they also have a higher risk of heart disease and many types of cancer. So they're across all health conditions, there are socioeconomic influences that are poorly explained, but probably involve the environments that people live in. If you are poor and uneducated, your occupational exposures to unsanitary conditions and air traffic fumes are going to be higher. You're going to be living in much higher density. Your children won't have separate bedrooms. They may be sleeping with the parents. There may be multiple shifts of people sleeping in the same bed. I mean, this is very common across all populations in the poorest groups. So all of those are factors that increase risk of infectious disease, marginal malnutrition, chronic stress, all of which increase risk of disease, chronic diseases.
Yeah, you had a list of pros and cons here. One of the pros was they might have better drugs. I mean,
you know, could afford them and have access to them.
Better pharmacogenetics, understanding of how the drugs are operating and so on.
And tailored for the individual, yeah.
Use of new stem cell technologies to perhaps perform.
Those are all expensive, and it remains to be seen if any of the standard medical plans will carry them, will cover them.
Against, you had things like this epidemic of obesity, which is in theory fixable. Air pollution, inflammation, leading to inflammation, you just talked about that. Global sanitation, rapid spread of infectious diseases. Some of this, frankly, came down to garbage.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, this is a no-brainer. It's there in front of our eyes.
But, I mean, we hear about the buildup of deleterious mutations in the genome, which is sort of internal garbage, but you're actually just talking about practical...
Yeah, ordinary garbage.
Outside garbage.
Yeah, right.
And the risk of infections and so on. So, I mean, do you have any optimism here? Is this an alarm call?
It's alarming. It's alarming. And I see the dichotomy between the clean industrial civilizations in the temperate zones and the increasingly squalid conditions in the equatorial zones that house the bulk of the world's population. It's horrendous to really recognize the depth of the deterioration, and at the same time the political expectations of those people are increasing because they're flooded by the media of what a beautiful life it is elsewhere. Yeah. So I think it's politically explosive.
Certainly, as we sit here in an air-conditioned room in a nice library...
What do we need air conditioning in Santa Fe for? It's beyond me.
Maybe it's off. maybe they're saving. But certainly, one does not have regular daily pictures in one's mind of conditions in other parts of the world that are under
stress. Well, not to mention conditions in some parts of Santa Fe and Albuquerque, where people are living in really... poor conditions. This state has a baseline, low economic basis.
So, interestingly enough, what we go on to at some of the meetings that we do is to say, well, that's the science. Now, how do we look at the ethics involved here? And you then find yourself discussing theories from philosophers like John Rawls, the late John Rawls, who talked about fairness and justice and distributive justice and so on. This seems like a huge issue on a global basis.
Well, I think it is. And I think it builds directly on the history of fairness in education opportunities and in nutrition and housing. This is part of that discussion that was begun in the early 19th century. And we're going to have to confront this not only nationally, but internationally. And the rallying of major philanthropy to eliminate smallpox and polio, and now trying to attack HIV, those are wonderful goals, but there's a much larger reservoir of desperation in health that's all around that hasn't been put on the agenda, I think because it's so big, it's imponderable.
When you go to meetings and talk about this, I mean, do you find that people are beginning to get energized, or are they just basically throwing up their hands?
It is frankly the meetings that I go to, which have to do with basic research, this is not a topic. It's an occasional topic in meetings of the epidemiologists and demographers, but I think this is the looming decades ahead looming question in the decades ahead.
Yeah. How did you get into this line of business? I'm just curious how this...
Well, in ancient days, as an undergraduate at Yale, in the biophysics group, where I had some wonderful mentors, and they knew I had an adventuresome and restless mind, and one person in particular, Carl Woese, I was talking about developmental biology as a great open field for inquiry, and he said, well, why don't you think about aging? It's even more obscure than development. Nobody knows anything about it. And that stuck in my mind, and I began to think about it. And when I was in graduate school at Rockefeller University, I was very fortunate to have a mentor there, Alfred Mirsky, who accepted my interests and encouraged me to develop a project on aging, which launched my career. So 40 years ago, I got my PhD for a project on essentially a systems analysis of gene regulation in the liver in a context of stress, which was a prototype of a lot of things that I've done since, to try and identify how aging in particular organ systems interacted across the body.
And Carl was working on Origins of Life.
Yeah, Carl had just started his thinking on that, and he was at Yale until 1959, and then he left and began to work on evolution of life. I'm still in touch with him. He's a wonderful colleague.
Tom Kirkwood brought to my attention the fact that one of my former professors at the Salk, who sadly died a couple of years ago, Leslie Orgel,
I knew Leslie,
although well known for work on Origins of Life, also had some very prescient things to say about aging.
Yes, he set up a mark that identified a whole set of really productive research lines on error catastrophe theories of aging, which have turned out not to be demonstrated, but at least got a lot of us into productive arguments amongst ourselves and with Leslie to define our parameters more carefully and move our field to a deeper level of analysis.
Yeah, people reminded me that at one of the lectures that, and in fact, I remember him saying this, he would often say, well, this is not my field, but, and then he would come forward with this brilliant idea.
He was wonderful at that. Well, so was Francis Crick.
Yes, yes, indeed.
I miss both of them.
Was there any plan plotted out from here that you had a sense of new alliances, new strategies emerging, or early days yet?
Well, I think it's early days, and it was a great idea to bring us together in this wonderful place. I've been here on other occasions, but did something immediately actionable come out of this? I think the NIA staff will be receptive to further grants for proposals for further meetings and for individual grants. And my guess is that will be two or three such things that will be proposed. Yeah. I wouldn't predict who's going to step forward.
You talk to public audiences, though. You talk to
I talk regularly.
General audiences, yeah. Yes. You do a lot of that. You probably know that there was a Pew report came out recently. I mentioned that in the introduction, that seemed to suggest that the divide still exists between a public that is usually found wanting on its level of scientific information, scientific literacy, and a scientific community that doesn't think much about the level of scientific literacy and doesn't seem to be doing much to correct it. I mean, to be honest about that. How do we start remedying that when you have a president in office who wants to restore science to its rightful place? What is its rightful place?
Well, at my university, the University of Southern California, a number of us are quite proactive in bringing discussion into the public. I think Los Angeles has a major resource with the three, four universities there, USC, UCLA, Caltech and City of Hope, which is now a university. So there's a higher level of communications in Southern California, and of course Orange County and San Diego County, premium places for scientific research. But it is a fact that it is awkward for many of my colleagues to talk to general audiences, and it's something that I've been asked to do since the time I came to USC and devote effort to it, because I think it is so important that the public, which supports our research programs, understand what we're trying to do and how difficult it is to make scientific progress is not widely recognized. And the media is sometimes not very helpful in propagating any finding as a breakthrough. Science just crawls along, and once in a while there is something that really makes a difference, but it's often years afterwards that it could be called a breakthrough. So we have very few things that are equivalent to the polio vaccines, for example.
And those breakthroughs often, there's a news story comes out 3 months later saying, sorry, it wasn't a breakthrough.
It wasn't quite as good as we thought. Yeah. Well, so it's a judgment call as to when you want to bring to the media's attention something that you think is significant.
These are all certainly the scientific disciplines and areas of scientific research, but they're also front page items. I mean, if you're talking about sleep or education or aging or diet, nutrition, these are things that are in the home every day, all the time. And it does seem to me that I don't know how you feel about this, that there ought to be more cross-fertilization of information, interest getting out there and so on.
You mean between the scientists?
Between the scientists and then in communicating it.
Yeah. Well, you can never have too many discussions with non-scientists. It's
Where do you think the aging scientific community working on aging should be going at this point? What are the most likely areas to produce
well,
results, do you think?
I think that there will be a highly productive line of research and understanding more about the unique human biology of aging. We've learned a great deal from the short-lived animal models that undergo their aging in a couple of weeks or a month or two. But humans are exceptionally long-lived, and the environmental effects on our patterns of aging are very deep. And I think there will be a great deal that will be understood about how the environment and human genes interact in outcomes of aging. And I'm teaching my students that their generation will need to become really good human biologists and understand aspects of our biology that are unique and not shared with simpler animals. And certainly our social connections and context are really important. Your risks of a heart attack or cancer are really influenced by the density of your social network, and that also is influenced by socioeconomic status. So this is awfully hard for molecular biologists to get their hands around, because it doesn't reduce to a single gene or a DNA change, but it's part of our unique evolution as a social species, in which our social interactions are major determinants of our health and our longevity. So this is a realm which I think will have increasing importance and will be taken down to gene environment levels as in the near future.
Sort of what are the major predictive factors? Because you read news stories these days and they say, well, the biggest thing is whether you have friends or not.
Well, there's very sound data on that. It's not just friends, it's your family connections. So the total number of positive relationships you have is a major factor in your health. Not the only one, but it's a major factor. And this is not going to be changed by taking a pill.
How did you actually get into science itself? You told me how you selected aging having become a biophysicist, but what was there something that got you into science at all?
Well,
I always
was interested in science. It was hard to know from the age of five onwards. I loved to read what I could understand that time about physics and chemistry, and I had a few family members of prior generations who were scientists, nobody in my immediate family, but they would remind me that my great-great-grandfather was a pioneer chemist, and so that was somehow in the environment, and I was reasonably good as a science student, and that propelled me to continue. I one anecdote about it. I was a scholarship student at Yale in 1957, and that was not a high social status position. My mother was a single parent. My father died during the war. And my freshman week on campus, I was assigned as the, quote, bursary boy. Scholarship students were all to wait on tables in the upper class dormitories, meaning sophomore, junior year, senior year dormitories. And it was extremely unpleasant and humiliating social environment. And I stormed into the office of the bursary office that had allocated these jobs. And I said, I hear that there are upper class jobs which would allow me to be in a laboratory. I want one now. I don't want to wait tables for 20 hours a week to earn my scholarship money. And the woman was quite taken back. Nobody's ever come in to me like that, young man. I suppose I have to let you look at the book of upper class jobs. And so I thumbed through it, and anthropology, no, that wasn't quite it. Biophysics, that sounds interesting. Not knowing a thing about what biophysics was. But she said, all right, well, if you think you're up to it. And 10 minutes later, I was in the office of the chair of biophysics, Ernest Pollard, who was a wonderful man, who said, oh, young man, well, welcome to our biophysics department. And I know just the person to set you up with. And so I had an absolutely remarkable alternate environment to intellectual environment, to dorm life at Yale in 1957, by hanging around with this brilliant crowd of people coming in from physics to figure out biology in the biophysics department, and hanging around with graduate students and assistant professors really changed my social perspective on what a life in science was. It wasn't all geekdom. These were really interesting, sophisticated people, and I learned a vast amount that propelled me forward from that happenstantial experience of rejecting being called unpleasant names for not putting some snotty senior's plate and fork down in front of him in the right order.
Well, it's certainly a serendipitous story. That
Yale has changed a little bit in that
sense. Don't wait tables, too.
Yeah.
So in those years, I mean, those are the years that Murray Gell-Mann and Harold Morowitz, who I've just been talking to.
Yeah, and Harold was one of my great mentors in the Yale biophysics department. In fact, I had an extremely touching experience with him today. He remembered conversations we'd had when I was an undergraduate. I did a senior thesis with him, and we resumed discussions on origins of life. It was just marvelous to be back in touch with this great thinker who influenced me, 50 years ago.
Yeah, we had a great conversation a couple of days ago, and I was just telling Murray this morning, he was also telling me this story about, obviously he's so intimately connected with the whole notion of energetics, with entropy, with Boltzmann, and he told me the story of going to Vienna and looking for Boltzmann's tomb and so on and so forth. And then we got onto C.P. Snow and the two cultures, because of course that was one of Snow's determinants of whether you were cultured or not, whether you actually knew the second law of thermodynamics and so on. Can we just go there with you to the two cultures thing? Says this is the 50th anniversary year of the two cultures. Yeah. Do you see any healing of the divide?
Well, there's continues to be a major concern for both communities. It's unless you have some level of scientific literacy, you can't understand what we're doing, and yet, paradoxically, we can read the professional journals and the primary sources that are the objects of study of our colleagues in the humanities, and it's at least at USC we make major efforts amongst our communities to be in touch and serve on committees together and. But it's a terrible disadvantage if you are a historian or an English professor or a philosopher and don't know really what a gene is and how it works. You can get some sense by just reading sophisticated journals like The Economist, which does a very good job, but there's a limit on it. It really is, it's a tragedy of the development of the disciplines that people who don't feel comfortable with science in high school don't take the courses that would enable them to have college-level science, which would be at least an elementary intellectual toolkit to be able to follow the medical journals, for example. And
I assume from what you're telling about your formative experiences there that you go out of your way to make sure that your students are getting a rounded education.
Well, I do the best I can, and I mean, people follow their own interests.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I know you have to get back, so let me just ask you one thing. What are you optimistic about in your field, or generally?
Well, I think that we are understanding at a fundamental level the processes of aging and their relationship to outcomes of health and mental function during aging. I think I'm optimistic particularly about Alzheimer's disease in the next 10 years, that it'll be possible to control its course if somebody has it, and to overall lower the risk for it. I believe that's the case. And there are a lot of important drugs that are in the pipeline. I have to acknowledge I'm a founding member of a biotech company, Acumen Pharmaceuticals, that has some patents on amyloid-related drugs. But I'm quite optimistic that this will be realized. What I'm concerned about is when it is realized, whether the expense of these drugs will make them available to more than this referred to health elite.
Do you actually, on this notion of elite and so on, do you think that the suggestion that you can engineer and remove some of these in a stepwise fashion, some of these barriers to extending lifespan, is giving people a false sense of hope, or is it realistic?
Well, I think it's realistic, whether it's accessible to the larger body politic is going to be the hot question.
Yeah. Interesting times to live as a scientist. If you hadn't been a scientist, is there anything else you would have liked to have been?
Well, I might have considered going into politics.
Well, you could still could.
Yeah, but I'm not. That's not a, not an interest. In
well, I mean, just if you look at the number of people who actually have science, or medicine or technology as a background in, say, the UK, houses of parliament.
No, it's Lords significant.
Significant. Yeah. Here, I think it's about 5 out of 535.
Congressmen, yeah. We're lower than Europe.
According to an editorial in Science by Norm Augustine, if you look at the 9 leaders in China, 8 of them got science backgrounds.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
So something needs to be done.
Yep.
So you should run for Congress, Tuck.
I've got my plate full, and I think my time and energies at age 70 would be best sticking to what I'm doing in a very exciting, productive phase of things with these new projects.
I wish you well.
Thank you.
Thanks.